And our theme this evening is a king in righteousness, a king in righteousness. In the Hebrew text, there is no real break between 1 and 2 Samuel. They're not intended to be, there's not intended to be a sharp division here, because they're all one and 2 Samuel together give one continuous account. And we've seen in the earlier part of this in 1 Samuel, we have seen the contrast between Saul, the people's idea of a king, and David, the man after God's own heart. And in the earlier part of this 2 Samuel, we see the rise of David to the throne of all Israel. It was not straightforward, it didn't happen in a moment, but it was marked by righteousness and justice. David, during this period, as he moves towards the throne of Israel, his conduct is marked by integrity and righteousness. Only over Zeruiah's sons, Joab and Abishai, was he restricted in the execution of justice, not simply because they were his relations, but because of their influence as leaders of the troops. But he commanded Solomon later concerning Joab. But his rise to the throne is characterized by justice and judgment, and the Spirit of Christ in him, as the Spirit of prophecy, increasingly focuses on the one who is yet to come, so that the emphasis on the not just David, but David as the forerunner and forefather according to the flesh of the Christ of God becomes stronger as this book continues. It should be noticed also that the last few chapters of 1 Samuel are designed to focus on David as the one to be king instead of Saul. This accounts for the unusual arrangement of the last few chapters, that we go from David to Saul and then back to David and then back to Saul, because the contrast is deliberate. And that's why we have such an account of what was actually a minor skirmish at Ziklag, as well as the great battle of Gilboa. I suppose a secular historian writing of this period would scarcely have noticed Ziklag and what was going on there compared with the momentous battle on the mountain of Gilboa. But the inspired writer was directed to show us what was happening with David as well as what was happening with Saul. Now in this chapter we are given the account of the death of Saul and Jonathan that was given by the Amalekite. Now this Amalekite, his account of the death of Saul, although in certain respects it corresponds with what you have in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, in other respects it is quite contradictory. The liberals, despite their often high intellect, show their spiritual darkness and stupidity by saying that there's a problem. There's a problem, they say, between the Amalekites' account and the account in the last chapter of 1 Samuel. Of course, there's no problem. It's quite obvious that the last chapter of 1 Samuel gives us what actually happened, and that what we have here in the first chapter of 2 Samuel is an embellished account by a man who was a mercenary liar, hoping to ingratiate himself with the aspiring king of Israel. And so that brings us, firstly, the unbeliever's inability to understand godliness. The unbeliever's inability to understand godliness in the first 10 verses. The Amalekite story, as we've said, contained element truth. Saul and Jonathan were dead. Saul had indeed sought someone to kill him, but not this Amalekite. And this Amalekite evidently did have Saul's crown and his bracelet. The bracelet would be an armlet worn above the elbow, as kings often did. But the idea of a stray Amalekite being the only one around when the king was wounded and being able to take the crown and bracelet before the Philistines arrived is somewhat far-fetched. The Amalekites were devoted to destruction according to the word of God. It is unclear whether this man was a proselyte who joined Israel and was actually present and witnessed the suicide. That is quite possible. What an Amalekite was doing as a proselyte in Israel, we just don't know. Certainly he knew that Saul and Jonathan were dead. He knew enough of the internal politics of Israel to know that David was heir apparent, in the sense that he was the one who was looked to by many as the future king. He also knew that David had been persecuted by Saul. But he didn't understand David. He didn't understand David. He didn't understand his godliness. And that's why he came with this story. Saul and Jonathan are dead. In fact, I'm the one who killed Saul. He expected great reward for both his actions and his message. He assumed that David was governed by mere ambition and therefore would be overjoyed by the news. He assumed at the very least that whatever outward displays of grief David engaged in, inwardly he would be entirely pleased and would reward this Amalekite. But David's godliness was genuine, and it wasn't just an outward thing, it was in his heart. David was grieved for Saul as well as Jonathan. He did love his enemy. He did recognize what Saul had done for Israel, and he did grieve over the dishonor done to God by the Philistines rejoicing in their victory. All of these things were true of David in his heart. But this man didn't expect it to be so, because he thought everybody was like him. The non-Christian expects the Christian, openly or secretly, to think as he does. And that's why he's so often baffled when this isn't the case. He's either baffled by what he sees, or else he thinks and tries to prove that it can't be genuine, that the outward is only a sham, and that this Christian cannot really think like that. The absence of the same selfish motive in David was not anticipated by this man. The unselfish love to God, and therefore his obedience to the law of God, was something he hadn't reckoned with. Like Job, who still loved God when everything seemed to have gone, and Satan sought to disprove that there was such a thing as the kingdom of grace. And this man doesn't understand the kingdom of grace. He doesn't understand the change that the Spirit of God has wrought in David's heart, and he doesn't understand the way a regenerate man thinks. And so he assumes that David will be like him. And if he were in that position, he'd be over the way that Saul was dead, and he would reward the man who'd killed him. And so we deduce that from the first 10 verses, where this man gives his false account. But then secondly, where David's heart really was. Where David's heart really was. Verse 11, "Then David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. Though through his sinful folly David was at Ziklag, yet David, and no doubt some of his men also, loved the Lord, and they loved the Lord's cause, and they loved the Israel of God. And so they mourned for Saul and for Jonathan, and we are told for the people of the Lord. Because although they'd ended up in Ziklag, their heart was still towards the Lord and his people. Zion's cause ought to be dear to us, looking not upon our own things, but the things which are Jesus Christ's. And it was in this situation that David's true state of heart is brought to the surface. David's own career was not his chief concern, but the honor of the Lord God of Israel and his cause. And that should be so with us. Many Christians today treat the cause of truth as a mere extra, a hobby that somewhere down the list, career and possessions still have priority. But it was not so with David. When he heard of Saul's death, his own career prospects, of course, took a leap forward. But he lamented and he mourned. And he mourned over the defeat of Israel. Zion's cause ought to be precious to us. The saints of God take pleasure in her stones, and they favor the dust thereof. And the low state of the church ought to be a source of sorrow to us, a sorrow that stirs us to prayer constantly that the Lord will plead his own cause. Thirdly, the throne to be established in righteousness. The throne to be established in righteousness. Verse 13 to 16. And David said unto the young man that told him, "Whence art thou?" And he answered, "I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite." And David said unto him, "How hast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and fall upon him." And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, "Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth hath testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed." We must remember the following things. Firstly, David took the man at his own word. Though he may well have suspected some falsehood, according to law, his guilt was established by his own testimony. And as the rightful heir to the throne, David was right to pronounce sentence. There was a just basis for holding this man guilty. He said he killed Saul. David treated him as the man who killed Saul. Secondly, the man was guilty of murdering the king. The man was held guilty. He wasn't actually guilty, he didn't do it, but he was held guilty of murdering the king. He said he'd done it. This is not altered by the fact that he alleged that the king wanted him to do it. Voluntary euthanasia is still murder. And the fact that, according to his account, Saul couldn't survive, Saul asked him to do it, does not alter the fact that David treated him as the murderer of the king. Thirdly, it was the principle of not lifting up his hand against the Lord's anointed that David had acted upon when under temptation to kill Saul. Of course, murder is always wrong. But it's even more wrong if the person murdered has a position of authority, because it is not only an attack upon the life of that individual, it is also an attack upon the authority which he represents. And in this case, Saul had been anointed king according to the command of God. So that to kill Saul was not only the murder of an individual, it was also an attack upon the authority of God who'd caused him to be anointed king, because it belonged to God to remove Saul from the kingdom. And David had been tempted to kill Saul, and David, to our thinking, had good reason to kill Saul, but he would not lift up his hand against the Lord's anointed. Yet this Amalekite did what David had not done. Or at least he said he'd done it. In fact, he hadn't. Fourthly, this principle had to be upheld now when David was about to move towards the throne. No doubt could affordably be cast on David's attitude to and dealings with Saul. And no suspicion had to be created that he connived at Saul's death. David had refused to lift up his hand against the Lord's anointed, and he could not countenance a man who said that he had. And so David was right to pass the death sentence upon this man on the basis of his own testimony, albeit it turned out his testimony was false, but that was upon his own head and only his own. Then fourthly, we have David's great lament, verse 17 to the end. David's great lament, verse 17, and David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. The book of Jasher is mentioned earlier in Joshua and chapter 10 and verse 13. Joshua 10:13, and the sun stood still and the moon stayed until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down about a whole day. And it seems that this book of Jasher, or it is thought that it was a collection of poems over many generations commemorating great events in the life of Israel. And we're told he bade them teach the children of Israel the use of the bow. Now you see that the phrase "the use of" is in italics to show that it's inserted to give the sense. Some take the reference to the bow as being a title to the lament, or else even the name of the tune. But our version may in fact be onto the right track, that at the same time as teaching this lament, David actually caused there to be more instruction on the use of the bow amongst the young men of Israel, because it was failure in this department that had been instrumental in the disastrous defeat at Gilboa. You remember, it was the archers that overwhelmed Israel, the Philistine archers, and therefore David was taking steps to rectify that. Belief in providence does not mean that we shrug our shoulders and learn nothing from what has happened and take no steps to prevent its repetition. That isn't belief in providence. That's just foolishness and irresponsibility and fatalism. And so if that is correct, then David was simply learning the lesson that Israel needed to work harder at the use of the bow. But then, looking at the lament itself, first of all, the theme is given in verse 19. The beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? That's the theme, that's the refrain, and it comes back later on. But then we have the sorrow for the loss of great leaders in verse 20 to 24. Sorrow for the loss of great leaders. Firstly, there is the rejoicing of the ungodly. Verse 20, tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. The Philistines rejoiced. The uncircumcised, those outside the professing church of God. And of course the honor of the Lord is bound up with the state of his church. The cause of truth and his true worship reflects upon the honor of God before men. God is glorious anyway. Nothing can take away from that. But the vindication of that honor and the upholding of that honor before men is bound up with the state of the church and the cause of truth and the true worship of God. And therefore David laments at the joy of the ungodly. You see, those things which cause joy to the ungodly cause sorrow to the godly. It's not just a question of national triumph and defeat. The sorrows of the godly, those sorrows, those things which are the distinctive cause of sorrow in the godly, that cause the godly to sorrow and not the ungodly, cause joy in the ungodly. And the reverse is the case also. Because the godly, he loves what the world hates. He loves God, the world hates God. And there is a complete difference of direction. So that among the godly and the ungodly, there are things that cause sorrow to the ungodly and joy to the godly, and there are things that cause joy to the ungodly and sorrow to the godly. And therefore, the rejoicing of the Philistines is the sorrow of David. Then secondly, the death of the Lord's anointed. Verse 21, ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul as though he had not been anointed with oil. He says, let there be no dew or rain or produce on the mountains of Gilboa as a mark of sorrow at the death of Saul. The shield of the mighty, the shield that should have protected him, was vilely cast away. He was struck down as if he had not been anointed by the Lord. The shield may even refer not simply to Saul's literal own shield, but to the men around him who had failed to protect him. And then thirdly, there is reference to the father and son relationship. Verse 23, Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. The earlier part of the verse refers to the close intertwining of Saul and Jonathan's lives. They lived together, they fought together, they died together. He leaves out the conflict that arose in Jonathan because of his recognition of David. Jonathan was loyal to David, but so far as could be done consistently with that, he was a loyal and dutiful son to his father. And the latter part of the verse rightly describes the might and courage and strength of Saul and Jonathan. And then fourthly, there is the prosperity that Saul brought. Verse 24, "Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel." He did. Saul was a mighty man in military terms. And David recognizes the military skill of Saul and the prosperity that this brought even to the daughters of Israel. But then the third section deals with the loss of his dear friend Jonathan. Verse 25, "How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women." After the refrain, he laments his own loss of Jonathan, who had loved him despite his father Saul. They were one in the faith in the Lord and love to the Lord. They experienced battle and danger together. Theirs was a spiritual brotherhood made all the stronger by shared experience. Jonathan's soul was knit to David when he heard him speak in the presence of his father. But that bond grew stronger by their experiences together. And of course that is true among the Lord's people, that adversity and affliction and the difficulties of the Christian life striving together for the faith of the gospel strengthens the sense of bond and of the bond of Christian fellowship among the people of God. And then we have the theme again in verse 27. How are the mighty fallen, and the weapons of war perished. He leaves us with the picture of the desolation of the battlefield. Warfare leaves heartache, and it did for David. Let us notice concerning this lament. Firstly, David tells no lies. David tells no lies. Not even about Saul, who had hunted him so unjustly. Never tell lies. Not even about the dead. Never tell lies. Not even about the dead. Ministers must not tell lies about those who have died. Nothing breeds more cynicism than at funerals when ministers tell things that are blatantly untrue, such as their anxiety to not offend and to please the family, that they end up saying things that are simply not true about the one who has departed. That should never be done. And not only should ministers not do it publicly, but we should not do it privately either. Even when confronted with distress, we must always stick to the truth. David did. Secondly, David does not say all that he could say. David does not say all that he could say. It is not necessary in every situation to speak all of one's mind. There are things in our minds that in any case that shouldn't be there. You know, there are people who glory in saying, "I like to speak my mind." The people who most say that generally don't speak their mind when it really matters, and speak their mind when they'd be better being quiet. When it really needs something to be said, they say nothing, and they say far too much when they'd be better, say, keeping quiet. There's a time to speak and a time to keep silent. It was not a compromise for David to refrain from speaking of Saul's sins now that he was dead. Only when necessary should we speak of the sins of the departed. There are times when it is necessary, but it wasn't at this stage. Thirdly, David said what good he honestly could of Saul. This is not wrong. It is not sinful to say what he could say by way of compliment to the memory of Saul. Even though we believe that Saul was not a regenerate man, he said what he could say, but not more. And then fourthly, David said what was true of Jonathan, even though he couldn't also honestly say the same of Saul. What was true of Jonathan and not true of Saul, he said. Jonathan had loved David, Saul had not. And so he tells the truth when he says, "Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women." He couldn't say that of Saul, but it was true of Jonathan. So he didn't deny the honor due to Jonathan's memory because he couldn't say the same of Saul. So then we have here an example of proper behavior in dealing with death and with what ought and ought not to be said. But overall, we are entering the period of David's ascent to the throne. This is one of his finest periods when he honors the Lord. Already we see the Christ of God set forth in David's Christ-like spirit. Because in David, the Spirit of Christ is at work. And in the life of David, especially these early chapters, we are given wonderful glimpses of him who was yet to come. Because the Spirit of Christ in him was the Spirit of the one who would come and sit upon his throne forever, and whose name shall endure forever, and whose name shall last like the sun.